Good day, citizens and podcast listeners. We're so pleased to bring you another, as Clay would say, exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week we talk about the Logan Act, which maybe at first blush sounds a bit dry, but it's not.
It's not dry. It's first of all, we're on a roll. We are having such a good time with the Thomas Jefferson Hour. It's like somebody put in pep pills into our milk or orange juice.
Can I tell them what's coming up in the next couple of weeks?
Yes.
We have two real special shows. One next week will be something we promised to do forever and ever, and we finally got it worked out, where we have actual callers call in and talk live to President Jefferson. And
then that was a kick.
And then the week after that, we have an extended interview with Charles Slack, author of Liberty's First Crisis. And I've just been blatantly pushing this guy's book because I liked it. I liked it so much because it does something that one of your books does. It gets in the head of a historical character, as your Meriwether Lewis book does. In this case, it really sort of helps us to understand some of the... just read the book. It's great fun. It's good stories.
America's First Crisis.
No. Liberty's First Crisis. Jefferson, Adams, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech.
It was great to talk with him. And I think you are right that his treatment of James Thompson Calendar is the fairest of any that I've read.
Anyway, this week's show, we talk about the Logan Act. We actually have a spirited discussion with President Jefferson about Virginia, the Dakotas, weather.
Lewis and Clark.
It was very
fun. Wind chill factors.
It was very fun.
But, so, you know, the Logan Act turns out to be very important. So I've been hearing about it. You have been hearing about it. General Flynn, his conversations with Russia during the transition between the Obama administration and the new Trump administration. And so you can't turn on any television news network of any sort without hearing Logan.
And seeing that clip of Michael Flynn at the convention saying, if I had done one-tenth of what that woman did, I'd be in jail.
At any rate, so the Logan Act has been around for more than 200 years. And so even though I've read about it a number of times in the course of my long interesting conversation with Thomas Jefferson, I went back and really did some research on it. It's fascinating that this involves partisan politics and the purity of our foreign policy and our undeclared naval war with France.
What was caused by a gentleman full of good intentions?
The Logan Act names George Logan, Dr. George Logan of Philadelphia, Quaker. He's probably the best person who has ever violated the Logan Act.
Well, wait, it's in the show. They can hear it.
It's amazing. So this is really an interesting one, and I think it's an important one. And I think that everyone, you know, we're going to be hearing about the Logan Act for weeks to come and maybe months. And it is possible that the Logan violations in this case will prove to be serious, and they may undermine the credibility of the administration of Donald Trump. We'll see. But under any circumstances, we all need to know something about it. And this show,
if it did happen, it would be the first time in American history that the Logan Act actually had an effect on it. Nobody's ever been prosecuted.
I don't think it'll lead to prosecution. What I'm saying is that it could lead to political turmoil.
That's something I would agree with. So let's go to the show.
Listen now to our attempt to clarify the origins and the continuing influence of the Logan Act of 1799. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now, I'm pleased to say, is President Thomas Jefferson. May we take a moment and talk about pleasant things, sir?
What might they be?
Well, I came out of my house the other day and looked in the sky, and it was black with geese flying over my home.
And that, in your part of the world, is a sign of spring.
It's time to get those charts out and get those garden books out and begin to grow some seeds and forget about the white winter behind us.
We had birds, of course, in the Blue Ridge and the South Mountains and Monticello, but you are, I think, in one of the world's great flyways.
Yes, we talk about the Dakotas, and I had to begrudgingly admit to you, sir, that there were days this winter where I believed you were pronouncement about the Tidewater area of Virginia being the best place to live.
No, not Tidewater.
Excuse me.
The mountains.
Correct me.
Malarial. That's Williamsburg. That's Washington, D.C.
I do need to spend more time in your beloved Virginia.
I moved to the westernmost part of the inhabited zone in Virginia. My father, Peter Jefferson, had chosen. He was one of the first three or four residents of our part of Virginia, and nothing could have made me live in Williamsburg except during the short governmental season when I was serving as the governor of that state.
As I say, I need to spend more time in your beloved Virginia, and
you must see the Natural Bridge.
Natural Bridge is worth a trip across the Atlantic. You could take me there if I came.
Of course, I delighted in taking people there.
Crawl out on the top, perhaps, and get dizzy, or
when I would stare over into that abyss even for half a minute, I would get a violent headache.
You know, Virginia, in its wisdom, has made that a state park to protect it, sir. That should make you very happy.
I take some credit for this because I purchased it in my life to prevent it from being exploited economically with mines or who knows what. I didn't want it to be ruined because I saw it as sublime, as one of the great examples of the sublimity of nature, the magnificence of nature. And I wrote to a number of people, including Mrs. Causeway, saying it's worth a trip across the Atlantic to see it. And she, as an artist, could come and paint it, and it would be regarded as one of the worthies of landscape painting. So I purchased it as a protection, as a conservation purchase. Of course, it later fell into private hands. But now, as I understand it, the Commonwealth of Virginia has acquired it, and I think that they will do everything in their power to maintain its primeval nature.
Well, I'm giving you great compliments for your beloved Virginia, but I also, sir, would love to have you and my beloved Dakotas to witness one of those magnificent sunsets or sunrises and watch these fields of grass blow in the wind. It's a wonderful place, sir.
Well, no, I know a little bit about this, citizen. My friend Meriwether Lewis was in your state for, I think, about 5 months in the autumn of 1804 and the spring of 1805, and he said that it was the windiest, most brutal place that he had ever seen in his life.
He was a Virginian, was he not?
They could kill a buffalo in November and it would still be frozen solid in May, that there was no need for salting their meat or jerking it because the place was so bitterly cold. I think that he recorded, he kept temperature twice a day at my suggestion. That had always been my habit in my life. And I think that on one occasion, he reported that it was 43 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Passing by that, Mr. President.
So I couldn't do it. I'm a mere orangutan.
Well, you could come in the summer months, and I think you would enjoy it immensely. Did Meriwether Lewis ever talk to you about what we call in Dakota the Badlands? The native peoples called it the place of good horse grass.
He did not. Now, one of his men that he acquired at Fort Mandan during that winter was a man named Baptiste Lepage. He was a French voyageur, and he had been trapping for beaver down in what you call the Black Mountains or Black Hills.
Yes.
And he was wanting to get back to Montreal because that's where the headquarters of the fur trade was at this time. And so he came down the Little Missouri River. And the Little Missouri River apparently starts in those Black Mountains somewhere.
Right, and
it flows north.
During his time, the Little Missouri was known for to be teeming with beaver.
And so he came down, that is north on this Little Missouri River, and got to the Mandan and Hidatsa villages in the autumn of 1804. Just as Lewis and Clark arrived, they met him and they debriefed him. And he told them what he knew. He apparently had made a bull boat, one of these ingenious boats made of kind of a willow trough.
Because one needs to know what
they're
doing. Covered
with buffalo hides, and he had floated down this river, the Little Missouri, thus becoming the first person we know of ever to make the journey along the entire course of that river. And then when he got to the Mandan and Hidatsa villages, he met my young friend Meriwether Lewis, and Lewis needed some extra hands and wanted some knowledge of the West. And so he hired this Baptiste Lepage to go with him all the way to the Pacific Ocean and back again.
Well, sir, if occasion ever affords the both of us the time, I think we would, I know I certainly would enjoy showing you my Dakotas, and I would love to have you show me your Virginia.
Well, I can't imagine wanting to see bad lands. I want lands that can grow wheat and rye.
Well, like I say, the native peoples called the Badlands the lands of good horse grass. Well, you can imagine that.
Fair enough. I do like the sublime. Is there sublime country out there?
Oh, certainly, sir.
I'd like to see these rivers, and I would. You know what I would like to see is the confluence of the Yellowstone and the Missouri.
Yes, I've been there, sir.
Mr. Lewis arrived there in April, late April of 1805, and he stopped to get celestial measurements for latitude and longitude, and he was so taken by that meeting of two great western rivers that he said that someday there would be trade forts there and that this would be one of the centerpieces of our international river traffic in North America.
Well, sir, I so enjoy my conversations with you. And here we are. We've just begun, and we've talked about gardens, and we've talked about places that we love.
And the bitterly cold climate of your North Dakota.
And weather. Really, what I was hoping to talk to you about this week was some of the regulations, rules, and laws that surrounded the early government during your time. One in particular that I don't think a lot of Americans understand, and I was hoping you could educate myself and your listeners, sir, the Logan Act, why it came into place, why it was needed, what your feelings are about that.
Well, it all goes back to the quasi-war, the undeclared naval war that we engaged in with France between 1798 and 1800. Now, France had been our principal ally during the War of National Independence. In fact, it's fair to say, I think, that we would not have won the war as quickly and possibly not at all without French loans and the French gift of Lafayette and others who came to fight on our behalf and on behalf of the project of human liberty. And Yorktown was essentially won because the French fleet had bottled up Cornwallis on this peninsula at the Chesapeake. So we owed France a great deal, and to my deep disappointment and chagrin, in 1798, the United States found itself at odds fundamentally with France, and America's first undeclared war, a naval war, was fought with France under the Adams administration. I looked on helplessly as the Vice President of the United States.
The law was named for George Logan, right?
A Pennsylvania Quaker, an extraordinary man, a very good man named George Logan, was as upset as I was to see our really important alliance with France in such disarray.
But he was not a member of the government, was he?
He was a mere citizen. He was a doctor.
So it sort of baffles me of why is it a bad thing for a well-meaning citizen to talk to a foreign government?
Well, I'm not certain. So he undertook to make a voyage at his own expense as a mere citizen to France. He found his way to Paris, and he met with Talleyrand and other members of the French government, and he expressed to them his own sorrow that this conflict had occurred. He said that most Americans were eager for an accommodation and that we were mystified that we couldn't get along better with our ancient ally, France, and that he wanted to do whatever he could to assure the French people that this was a crisis that could be overcome by forbearance and good sense and a renewed initiative. And in fact, he was very successful. Not only did he meet with Talleyrand, but he was able to get several American seamen who were captives under this undeclared naval war released. And he sort of sent up a trial balloon to Talleyrand and said, if President Adams sent over another peace mission, would you receive it? Would you look favorably on another peace initiative that the Adams administration might reach out to you with? Would you receive those envoys? Would you give them diplomatic credit? And would you treat with them to try to resolve the outstanding issues between the Republic of the United States and the Republic of France? And the response that he got was that the French were cautious, but they would indeed receive another diplomatic mission and would look forward to finding some way to resolve the tensions between the two great nations.
Mr. President, I understand that there are always at least two sides to an issue as complex as this, maybe more than two sides. I'm hoping during our discussion this week, you might help me and your listeners to understand both points of view. I mean, I suspect that the thin skin that Mr. Adams exhibited at times had something to do with this law?
No. The amazing thing is that when he got back, George Logan, at his own expense, he presented himself to John Adams. John Adams took the meeting. He told Adams what he had done and what he had discovered in France. And Adams was skeptical, but he was intrigued. And Adams went on to take Logan's advice, and on the basis of the word that he had received that another delegation would be acceptable to France, that's precisely what President Adams did. And in doing so, he not only put an end to the conflict, but he so upset the war party in the United States, principally Alexander Hamilton, that Hamilton never forgave him. And when John Adams came to write his epitaph much later in life, he said that he wanted to be remembered as the person who, under provocation of war in 1798, sent a second extraordinary peace mission to France and preserved world peace. And so the Logan event, Logan's visit to France and its aftermath, actually led to a breakthrough that John Adams came to admire. He did not blame Logan for his private diplomatic activities.
You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and this week we're discussing the Logan Act with President Jefferson. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. So pleased to see you this week. Enjoyed our conversation so far, Mr. President. We've moved into talking about the Logan Act, something that's come up in the news these days, and I thought it would be instructive and helpful for me and your listeners to get your perspective on it. But I'm a little confused right now. Why do we even need it?
Well, what happened was that this Quaker philanthropist, in the best sense of the term, a lover of humankind, at his own expense, undertook to go to France and to try to ease the tensions between our republic and theirs, and he was successful. He met with Talleyrand. He came back. He brought peace feelers from the French government. He met with President John Adams. Adams was skeptical, but he realized that Logan had done something important, and this allowed the breakthrough that led to the peaceful conclusion of the undeclared naval war, the quasi-war. But the Hamilton party, Hamilton was not in the administration. He was back in New York, but he was sort of pulling the strings of the cabinet of John Adams, a cabinet that was a carryover cabinet from the Washington administration. That cabinet was appalled by what Logan had done. They wanted a war. Hamilton wanted a war. It was his greatest thirst in life to be a commander of some great army somewhere.
Oh, do you really think the man was that small that he would do that?
Yes. I know he did. And Timothy Pickering was the Secretary of State.
Pickering is another story.
But Hamilton wanted his war. And he was so angry that Adams had sent that second diplomatic mission that that's partly why Hamilton wrote the pamphlet against Adams that was leaked by Aaron Burr and destroyed Adams' chances of being reelected in 1800. Hamilton was angry that his chance of military glory to resurrect his fading centrality in American political life had been destroyed by this peace feeler, and he felt that Adams had no right to do it and that he was doing it personally, that it was a personal attack on Hamilton rather than what it really was an attempt to avoid a war that the United States didn't want to fight against a trusted and ancient ally. Anyway, Pickering, the Secretary of State, thought, who's this Logan and why is he interfering in my portfolio? And so Pickering then approached Congress through Representative Roger Griswold of Connecticut and said we needed, quote, I'm quoting Pickering, an act to curb the temerity and impudence of individuals affecting to interfere in public affairs between France and the United States.
Well, so the problem was, as Logan thought, if he went for being the good guys, everyone would appreciate that. But that what you're saying is that wasn't the case.
No, the Federalists were appalled by this, the High Federalists and the Hamiltonians, and they hated what John Adams did to end the tensions in the Quasi-War. But they really resented that Logan had been the one to create the breakthrough because he was a mere private citizen, and he, in a sense, had embarrassed them because they had made lip service to peace, but they weren't really trying to bring it about. And so suddenly somebody who has no credentials of any sort goes and provides a diplomatic breakthrough that the officials of the State Department were incapable of providing. And so Pickering proposes that Congress adopt this law. Griswold puts it to the House of Representatives. It was pushed through hard by the Federalist majority, 58-36 in the House of Representatives and 18-2 in the Senate.
I might get us a bit off topic, but I just must ask you, it's on my mind. Mr. Pickering, I've done some reading about him, and he is, in what we would call my terms, considered to be a piece of work. Did you have any dealings with Mr. Pickering?
Of course. He loathed me. He did everything in his power to undermine me. He despised me personally. He despised my principles. He was what we would have called a High Federalist or a Tory, and he was nothing but trouble. And, of course, Adams eventually realized this, that Pickering was really just a tool of Colonel Hamilton, and then fired him.
Well, I heard that he asked Mr. Pickering to resign, and Mr.
Pickering refused, so then Adams had to fire him. But the problem that Adams had, his greatest mistake in his life, was to keep the cabinet of Washington when he became the second president. He thought it was an act of respect to the great man and also an act of respect to the continuities that are required in a new government like our own. But he didn't know, in keeping George Washington's cabinet, that someone behind the scenes, in this case Colonel Hamilton, was actually serving as the shadow president of the United States, and Adams' cabinet were responding more to Hamilton's ideas in New York than they were to those of the actual sitting president of the United States. At any rate, Pickering, appalled by Logan's action, embarrassed by the success of Logan's action, helps the Federalists force through Congress the Logan Act, named after Logan, 58-36 in the House, 18-2 in the Senate. Now, Logan could not be prosecuted because our Constitution has an ex post facto provision that says you can't be prosecuted by a law that wasn't in place at the time you committed the so-called crime. So Logan was fine. But thereafter, it became officially illegal for a private citizen of any sort, no matter how well-intentioned, no matter how personally close to the administration, it became illegal for a private citizen to engage in foreign policy on behalf of the United States of America. That law, passed in 1799, has been in place ever since.
A felony, too. Not a slap your wrists, but a felony.
But the amazing thing about Logan is,
I was going to ask, what became of him?
Well, he wasn't punished, and he was appointed and eventually elected as a Republican, my style of Republican, to the United States Senate from Pennsylvania. And he served from July 13, 1801, during my first term, to March 3, 1807, so towards the end of my second term.
Did you have any personal connections with Mr. Logan, or
yes,
any correspondence with Mr. Logan that you can recall?
Yes, we were friends for other issues. He was a Quaker and physician and a man of letters, and so I knew him through the American Philosophical Society and through what I call the Republic of Letters during my time in Philadelphia, and we were good friends, and I actually sent letters of introduction with him when he went to France on that mission. It wasn't illegal at the time. And so he asked me to establish a connection between him and some of my friends in Paris, and I happily wrote letters of introduction for him. So he was, in a certain sense, traveling with my good wishes at hand when he went to Paris in 1798.
Well, I'm certain that must have opened some doors for him, sir.
It did, and but I say the friendship was mostly about intellectual subjects, medicine, science, invention, the Republic of Letters, things that had little or nothing to do with his diplomatic mission. But I repeat the most important single fact about this. The Logan Act was punitive, done after the fact, after a successful negotiation by a private citizen that certainly put an end to the war of 1798, the quasi-war, much more quickly than it otherwise would have occurred. It might have saved lives. It certainly saved treasure. By passing the Logan Act, the Federalists didn't necessarily do this country any good, and they didn't do it out of any high-minded sense of to protect the foreign policy purity of the United States. They did it because they were embarrassed that Logan had succeeded where they had failed.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week we're speaking with President Thomas Jefferson about the Logan Act. And Mr. President, if I could circle around to the beginning of our discussion about this, my initial reaction was, why do we even need this law? But I suspect you could come up with a situation where we might need it.
Well, I understand why it's important to protect the official foreign policy of the United States from private interference. Now, in this case, Logan was a lover of peace. He intervened successfully. He did a favor to the people of the United States and of France. He did it with the greatest sense of respect. Had his intentions been otherwise, had he gone to France to say, America is planning an invasion, you'd better prepare yourself, or America is talking about its war response, but believe me, nothing's going to happen. You can do whatever you want with impunity. The United States is too spineless and too poor to make a spirited response to your actions. Had he intervened with less than benevolent intentions, or had he misunderstood the purposes of the United States, or had he deliberately undermined the sovereignty and the foreign policy of the United States, he might have created a great deal of mischief. And so it probably is sensible that only accredited diplomats speak on behalf of the United States, especially in your time where the foreign policy concerns are so much denser and more intricate and more complicated than they could ever have been in my time, and the stakes are so much higher. The weaponry of your time is certainly fundamentally greater in magnitude than the sorts of missiles and swords that we were still using in the early 19th century. So I certainly understand why the Logan Act might make sense. It's unfortunately attributed to Logan's actions, which were exemplary and entirely positive. And the legislation, as I say, was a partisan, punitive measure that had little or nothing to do with the merits of private intervention in foreign affairs. But still, I think it's probably the case that it's useful to you as a nation to prohibit this sort of meddling.
I'm curious, Mr. President, just who could be prosecuted under this law. The reason I bring it up is reading about the sedition law during Mr. Adams' presidency. I was surprised to find out that individuals such as Adams himself and some of his secretaries could not be prosecuted under the law. But I noted that you, as vice president, could be prosecuted.
Right. That was another question. So the Sedition Act made it illegal to criticize the conduct of the government of the United States, and it named a number of people who were immune from criticism. And if they had been criticized by liberty polls or pamphlets or even orations, those writers could be prosecuted under the Sedition Act of 1798. This was a little bit different. This was a year later. Let me read to you the exact law, sir. Any citizen of the United States, wherever he may be, who, without authority of the United States, directly or indirectly, commences or carries on any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government or any officer or agent thereof with the intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government or of any officer or agent thereof in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States or to defeat the measures of the United States, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both.
Well, I guess that's the line, directly or indirectly commences or carries on any course.
So if Adams had said to Dr. Logan, I would like you, sir,
that's all it would have taken,
to go to Paris and see what you can accomplish.
Conversely, during my time, Mr. President, there was a dispute with a Middle Eastern nation, and I believe it was 40-some senators of the opposition party to the president who was in power wrote a letter directly to that government, and some feel that that was a violation of the Logan Act.
That would be a difficult one to prove because those people were elected officials of the United States government. So they were senators and congressmen. They weren't mere citizens. They weren't a Quaker physician from somewhere.
So that may be all right then.
I think you could make the case either way on that one because it's the executive which administers the foreign policy of the United States. And
the spirit
of the law is that the executive alone can decide who speaks for this country. And so the Congress, which doesn't have that authority under our Constitution, should not attempt to engage in private foreign policy. But these are elected officials, and I think it would be extremely difficult to make the case that they should be prosecuted under the Logan Act for that letter that you speak of.
Mr. President, as far as I can tell, no one has been successfully prosecuted under the Logan Act.
As I understand it, in the 200 years that this act has existed, no person has ever been prosecuted. I believe one person was indicted in all of your history, but nobody in all of that time has been successfully prosecuted, and only one person ever even indicted. So the Logan Act is invoked more often than it's applied or enforced.
It's almost like a political tool rather than a real law of enforcement.
But I think it also has had its influence. In other words, knowing that the law exists, private individuals have been frightened of getting involved in violations of this act. And I think the executive understands that the president alone must determine who speaks for this country. And so it probably has had a clarifying and even chastening effect on American foreign policy. I'm sure that more people have interfered as private citizens than have ever been indicted. In other words, I think it hasn't been particularly highly enforced in the course of American history, but every time a situation like this has come up, those who wish to could say, beware of violating the Logan Act, and that probably has chastened some filibustering.
It seems I'm trying to think of the only word I can think of is a contemporary one. That seems a bit chippy to me, Mr. President.
Well, many laws in the codes of the United States have never been applied or enforced, and so this
let me ask you then,
would be one of them.
Would you have supported this law? Would you have written this law? Would you have enforced it as president?
I might not have enforced it, but I think it's probably a good law.
You do.
It passed for the wrong reasons. Attacking a person who was innocent and even beneficial to this country. But probably we needed something like the Logan Act. You know, diplomatic relations are very difficult. Nations have complicated relations. So let's say the issue is the Outer Banks, fisheries. It's one thing for an executive and the Secretary of State and the official diplomatic establishment to try to sort through these issues. A mere citizen in Virginia or Maryland or, for that matter, Kentucky, looking at this through the eyes of newspapers or with his own hunches, may not be in possession of all the information he needs. He may misunderstand the official position of the United States. He may misunderstand the way that nations posture in diplomatic negotiations with other sovereign states. And so I think it's right that we are a nation, and the nation has official representatives, and those representatives are charged with the keeping of the peace and the maintaining of our engagements with foreign nations. And I think to keep that simple and focused is probably a good idea. Nothing prevents a President Adams from turning to Dr. Logan and saying, "Sir, will you go on my behalf to France and see what you can work out?" But doing it without letting the executive know in advance could, I think, lead to mischief. But let me give you an example of a much more severe problem.
Please.
When I was the Secretary of State, whose job it is to handle foreign relations, I was also in the cabinet of George Washington with Colonel Hamilton. And Colonel Hamilton decided that he would be the essential, the undeclared Secretary of State. And he was working with agents of the British government to undermine not only me, his rival in the cabinet, that's one thing, not of great importance perhaps. But he also said to the British agents, don't listen to whatever official pronouncements come out of the Washington administration. We have no interest in being in conflict with you. Whatever we say is merely to provide rhetoric in the international sphere. You can ignore any sense of threat that you might feel we are not going to wage war against you. We're not going to engage in economic discrimination against Great Britain. So you don't have to listen to anything that this government says, because I can assure you that my relationship with George Washington is such that I know what the old man really thinks. And so let me just tell you this. Whatever Jefferson says is the policy of the United States with respect to Great Britain, dismiss it, because it's not going to be enforced. And I disagree with Jefferson, and frankly, George Washington does too. That's a form of treason.
How did you find out about this, sir?
Well, I did find out about it through leaks, through people who believe in the sovereignty of this country and wanted the Washington administration to speak with one voice. And when I learned that Hamilton was literally undermining my office and the official foreign policy of the United States, and not at the request of George Washington, but on his own freelancing initiative, I was appalled. That's not only a terrible breach of loyalty, but it is treason.
Mr. Jefferson, I'm sorry we need to end our conversation on this subject. Any final thoughts for the American people on this?
My view is that the laws that you have, however they originated, should be enforced or repealed, and that it is certainly the case that in an era as complicated as yours and in a world as dangerous as yours, you want as a nation to speak, if possible, with one diplomatic voice.
You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, and your weekly conversation with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And this week, it was so fun to talk to Mr. Jefferson about gardening and the Dakotas and
Lewis
Virginia
and
how weather.
Brutal.
And
I was offended that he was attacking the brutality of our winters.
Well, that's,
you and I live here.
That's to be expected.
And Jefferson didn't even know about the wind chill factor. When I was young, I didn't believe in the wind chill factor, yeah, but believe me, there is a wind chill factor.
But you called the subject for this week, and a good one it is. It's in the news so much, the Logan Act. I'm kind of left after talking to Jefferson with wondering, do we really need this? On the other hand, you look at some of the potential prosecutions in the last 30 years, and I don't know, maybe we do.
Well, there's never been a successful prosecution. There's only been one indictment. I think it's usually used as a partisan matter. So let me give you one example of that. Ronald Reagan was really angry when Representative Jim Wright of Texas became involved in our international crisis with the Sandinistas during the Iran-Contra war period. And that tells you, George McGovern was accused of violating the Logan Act when he was a United States Senator from South Dakota by negotiations with Cuba. So what emerges from any examination of the uses of the Logan Act, David, is that it's usually a partisan threat made by the existing government when people outside the government are engaged in a kind of a diplomatic conversation that the administration doesn't like. What I learned in preparing for this program, I didn't know much about the Logan Act. I was shocked, first of all, that I knew about what Logan had done, but I did not know two things. First of all, how successful it had been, what he did in France. And secondly, that when he came back, John Adams took a meeting with him and was actually pleased with what Logan had done. I did not know those things. And so then you discover that the Logan Act was a partisan attack on Dr. Logan, And it's been used largely in a partisan way ever since. And I must say, it may be now being used in a partisan way in the crisis, the early crisis of the Trump administration.
You know, the first time I recall hearing about it was during the Vietnam era.
Oh, Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda, yeah. And I didn't even...
Hanoi Jane.
Yeah. And
sitting with an aircraft battery in North Vietnam.
There was a much greater violation of that that you talk about in the Jefferson Watch.
In this week's essay, I'll tell you about the one involving Anna Chennault, who this was during the end of Vietnam and during the transition between the Johnson to Nixon administration.
Were I emperor for a day, I might prosecute that one.
Yeah. So it is possible for the Logan Act to have, I think the Logan Act has a legitimacy.
You think we need it?
Yes, I do. And I think it's also possible that it needs to be enforced from time to time.
Well, it comes up now because you hear it in the news. Michael Flynn resigned.
He seems clearly to have violated the Logan Act. Uh-huh. Now, whether it's of any consequence is another question. We'll find out.
Well, but maybe we will, maybe we won't.
But here's when this is dangerous, as in with the case with Anna Chennault during the Johnson to Nixon transition. This is what happens during transitions. So if General Flynn was engaged in conversations with Soviet authorities and basically said, yeah, the Obama administration is going to huff and puff about the hacking and so on. Don't take it too seriously. Once we're in power, we're going to make things much better. So
that would be violating the Logan Act.
And it really matters in a transition because the policy of the United States remains that of the sitting president until the moment she or he leaves office. And when the incoming people are deliberately undermining the policies of the United States in foreign relations, that can be a grave matter. And we don't know yet about this. It may have affected the election. If it's true that the Russians were hacking the Democrats and leaking information damaging to Mrs. Clinton, but not leaking information damaging to Donald Trump, if that were happening and it can be shown to have affected the outcome of the election, that's a very serious international problem, and the Logan Act should be very firmly enforced in such a situation. Unfortunately, the party in power, which also has majorities in both houses of Congress, is extremely unlikely to want to examine that one too seriously, I think.
Yeah, there's all these calls about fake news, and I think a good example of that was Meet the Press a week or so ago. Chuck Todd saying, there are 7 investigations going on, and there aren't. There are 7 different agencies vying for the position of who's going to investigate.
We live in a time of distortions in every direction. You know, we said in the program, there's only been one indictment in over 200 years under the Logan Act.
And who was that?
In 1803, so during Jefferson's first term, a grand jury indicted a man named Francis Flournoy, a Kentucky farmer. He had written an article for the Frankfort Guardian of Freedom, a newspaper, under the pen name of a Western American. And in that article, he had advocated a separate nation for the western part of the United States that would ally with France. That's it. He had written this thing, the West should secede and they should form a new republic and it should be in direct alliance with France. And for that, the U.S. Attorney for Kentucky, a John Adams appointee, in other words, a Federalist, and the brother-in-law of Chief Justice of the United States, John Marshall, another Federalist, got an indictment of him, but then it was dropped. So that's the only time in our history that there is actually, it's often invoked Jane Fonda, George McGovern, et cetera.
But it's
never been successfully
prosecuted. You look back at those early days of the Republic, the first dozen years, and you have these laws that are coming out that are like the Sedition Act, the Sedition and Alien Acts, the
naturalization law.
And you realize that something had to cause this. There were men who were pretty concerned about whether or not our republic was going to survive. That's my feeling, is that's why they must have done this.
But it was also a period of intense partisanship, and the biggest divide in the early national years was Britain v. France. And the Federalists, led by Hamilton, believed that our best interests were staying as closely aligned with Britain as we possibly could and putting up with a lot of abuse because Britain was our number one trade partner. They had the largest navy in the world. They were a fellow English-speaking nation, and in the long run, it was in our interest to make up with Britain. And then on the other hand, you had the sort of Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison wing of the American political system that believed France helped us during the war. They may have made it possible for us to win the war. France has also had a revolution. The rights of man mean something in France that they don't yet mean in Great Britain. We need to break our economic dependency on Britain. Britain should not have the ability to enslave us economically, even though we are politically independent. So you have the Jeffersonian Party, pro-France. You have the Hamiltonian Party, pro-Britain. This is a huge national debate during this period. It really rocked the country. The Jay Treaty is what propelled Jefferson out of retirement and back into the political process in 1796 and 1797. So this was really hot, hot material. And now, during the height of this quasi-war, Dr. Logan, encouraged by people like Thomas Jefferson, privately goes to France and works things out. And so the response was less, less high-minded than
it
was
illegal.
Openly partisan. How dare you? And I know you were a little skeptical in character, but David, the histories substantiate this, that Hamilton by 1798 had retired from the Washington administration. He'd gone back to New York. He was picking up a law practice. He felt that his career was over because, you know, the Maria Reynolds story had broken, and he wanted to do something to reestablish himself as America's greatest man, and he looked upon the quasi-war as his chance to lead troops successfully in battle against France, and when that fell apart, he wanted to lead them against the Jeffersonians in Virginia and Kentucky, at least to march through their states to show them what federal authority looked like. I know it sounds crazy, but he thirsted for war glory.
No, it
and
does
so
not.
When Logan goes over and solves the problem, Hamilton is livid because his comeback was going to be a successful military career in the height of this international crisis. And so Logan comes back and has this meeting with John Adams. John Adams does send the second diplomatic envoys to France. They are accepted, and they work out an arrangement that ends the quasi-war. And as I said, it's the most moving thing in the world. When Adams wanted to write his epitaph, it wasn't like Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence and the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty and so on. What Adams said is that he wanted to be remembered as the person who took the extra step of sending the second peace mission to France and preserved world peace at a time when he might easily have succumbed to war fever. When you read that about Adams, your respect for the old man just rises exponentially. This was one of the great selfless moments in American history, and it cost Adams re-election. Think of that. It would have been more popular for John Adams to let Hamilton have his way and fight an unnecessary war with France. That would have assured his re-election.
Well, you can say that, but no one can be certain of that. I mean, at that point, Jefferson, France was very high in everybody's opinion that Jefferson represented that connection, and it was only later on that that began to fall apart, right?
Hamilton was so angry that he wrote that pamphlet in which is dozens of pages attacking Adams in every possible way and saying he was unfit for high office. He thought that would be kind of a behind-the-scenes memo to his closest Federalist friends, and guess who found it? Somehow Aaron Burr got a hold of it. He then had it leaked to the press and it was published, and it was like a cataclysm because not only did it make Hamilton look like the unscrupulous, Machiavellian, mean-spirited, sour grapes guy that he was.
Who invented America.
Invented the fiscal system.
This is true.
But in addition to making him look terrible, disloyal, self-serving, narcissistic, mean-spirited, envious, but also—
You need a few more adjectives there, Clay.
Well, it's a very serious thing that he did.
I'm sorry.
And he also helped to cost John Adams' re-election, because if he hadn't written that pamphlet and the Federalists had rallied behind their incumbent, Adams probably would have won re-election. He certainly would have had a better chance to win re-election. And so Hamilton not only brought down chaos upon himself, but he brought down chaos on the Federalists and John Adams, and the Federalists never recovered, David. The Federalists were never a serious factor in American political political life again. And it doesn't, it's not altogether dependent upon that pamphlet, but it's largely dependent upon that pamphlet. And he wrote that pamphlet because John Adams wouldn't let him lead the war charge in 1798 and 1799.
Well, sir, it's been a spirited conversation. I've learned a lot this week. I have been curious about the Logan Act. I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that are. And certainly Mr. Jefferson and you have clarified that for us. But I'm afraid I've worked you up, and perhaps you need to take Mr. Jefferson's advice and, when angry, count to 100.
It would take 100,000 with Hamilton.
We were talking about the Logan Act earlier and referred to, but we didn't really talk about what may have been the most famous instance of the Logan Act or in the 20th century. And I know you're going to tell us about that because now, sir, it's time for the Jefferson Watch.
And it's going to include the words Richard Nixon. Thanks, David. The Logan Act has been around for 200 years. It was enacted in 1799 to prohibit private citizens from meddling in the foreign policy of the United States. It is sometimes invoked, but never really enforced, in part because for most of our history there has been a general consensus that party politics should be suspended at the shorelines of America. And there has been a nearly universal agreement that we should leave the intricacies of foreign policy to the elected government of the United States. The Trump administration's violations of the Logan Act are a serious betrayal of American foreign policy norms, but probably they won't change much or endanger anything really worth protecting in America's sovereignty. There have been much greater breaches of the Logan Act. The most important crisis of all came in the fall of 1968, when Richard Nixon was running for the presidency at a time when the war in Vietnam was tearing the United States apart. Nixon had what he called a secret plan for ending the war. Meanwhile, the Johnson administration was working hard to negotiate an end to the conflict. Nixon, who was famously paranoid, feared that the negotiations might succeed and that the vice president, Hubert Humphrey, might therefore win the presidential election. And Nixon wanted to end the war under his watch, so that he would achieve immortality as the peacemaker. Nixon encouraged a woman named Anna Chenow, born in Beijing, a mere civilian and an ardent Republican, and a Nixon supporter, to make back-channel contacts with representatives of the South Vietnam government to instruct South Vietnam to refuse to participate in the Paris peace talks and thus prevent a settlement from occurring before Nixon was inaugurated in January 1969. The Chenow interventions worked. The peace talks, which had been moving towards a peaceful settlement of the long, divisive, and tragic war in Vietnam, suddenly stalled out. Nixon was elected. He not only did not end the war, but he prolonged it, indeed expanded it into Laos and Cambodia. Remember the Kent State killings? 4 dead in Ohio? By the time the war finally ended in 1975, a year after Nixon's ignominious resignation for high crimes and misdemeanors, another 21,202 Americans had died in Vietnam, not to mention the tens of thousands of Americans wounded and the hundreds of thousands or millions of Vietnamese killed, maimed, and left homeless. It gets worse. The diplomatic settlement that ended American involvement, negotiated by Henry S. Kissinger, was essentially no different from what was on the table in Paris back in 1968. In other words, after 5 additional years of mayhem and national agony, the United States finally, in 1973, cut a peace deal that represented no measurable improvement over what President Johnson had been prepared to accept in the fall of 1968. That's a violation of the Logan Act. Mrs. Chenow should have gone to federal prison, at the very least. And Nixon should have been impeached for that appalling, cynical, and murderous interference in America's foreign policy. Compared to that, covering up the Watergate break-in is a puny indiscretion. Because of Citizen Nixon's illegal intrusion into the peace process, 21,200 Americans died when they might have come home to re-enter American life. By 1975, Saigon had been renamed Ho Chi Minh City. We lost the war, and in terms of our national psychology, we have never quite recovered. What Michael Flynn and others did between November 8, 2016 and January 20, 2017 seems insignificant by comparison. But of course, the full story has not yet been revealed, and the full implications of this most recent violation of the Logan Act have not perhaps yet worked themselves out. And remember the principal lesson of Watergate. It's not the crime that brings down an individual or a government. It's the cover-up. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.